Good morning, Nexus. Brad here from my home, and I've been trying to find new places around my house to shoot. And I thought I'd shoot in front of this painting here because this was the one thing that whoever owned the house before us, they left us. So when we moved in here 8 years ago, the house was empty, but in the basement was this painting. They left it for us. Nice little gesture. We didn't exactly love the painting, a little too Thomas Kincaid, whatever. So we left it in the basement for years, but finally we're like, we need something for this wall. And so about a year ago, we brought it up, we hung it here, and it takes care of the little foyer entrance. But I got curious about this painting. And so I started, right in the corner here is the name, the author of the painting, P. Nelson. And so I started looking up P. Nelson. I was curious, who made this piece of art? And as I started Googling this, I realized that P. Nelson was doing quite well with his art over in England. In fact, P. Nelson paintings were selling for $6,000 to $7,000, or what's the currency in the UK? The pound, £6,000 to £7,000 for his art. And so I was so excited. I'm like, oh my goodness, we have this valuable piece of art. And I told Kristen about this. I'm like, we should get this off and sell it because we don't love it. So anyway, I'm looking into selling this piece of art, and Kristen does some Googling of her own, and she informs me, Brad, I think you looked up the wrong P. Nelson. I had typed in P. N-I-E-L-S-O-N, and actually this is P. Nielsen, N-E-I-L-S-O-N, and there's nothing about him on the internet. Apparently his art is worthless, but here it is on our wall, so I thought I'd shoot in front of this worthless piece of art, but it's beautiful in its own little way. So here we are, getting close to Christmas, and the scene does, it conjures up some warm, Christmassy, snowy winter stuff for me. So hopefully this will serve all right as a background this morning. But that's not what I want to talk about this morning. I want to talk to you, tell you a little story about March 19th, 2003. You see, on the night of March 19th, I was taking a class on the Book of Isaiah. And I remember at the time, the class ran from 6:30 to 9:15 p.m. And things are a little different now, but back in the day, I loved night classes. Like, I was on. Those hours were some of my best for learning. And so I'm wide awake and ready to learn in this class, but I had an extra motivation to do well in this class on the Book of Isaiah. You see, I happened to be dating the professor's daughter. And so I was tuned in. I wanted to do well in this class. I didn't want to look like a slouch to my future father-in-law. I wanted to look real good, sharp, intelligent. So I was tuned into this class. And I remember on March 19th, 2003, sitting in that class and hearing the words of Isaiah speaking to me. Passages like these. Come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Isaiah 9, there will be trouble and anguish and dark despair. Nevertheless, that time of darkness will not go on forever. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. The boots of the warrior and the uniforms bloodstained by war will be burned, for a child is born to us. A son is given to us. And the government will rest on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His government and its peace will never end. And so the words of Isaiah are swimming in my head that night. And I remember getting out of class, and normally after class, what would happen in a night class is my friends and I, we'd go to a pub, but not on this night. You see, on this night we found a television in the dorm common room, you could say, and we plunked ourselves right down in front of this TV. You see, this was March 19th, 2003, and the world was on the eve of war. And so we flipped on CNN, and a bunch of us there sitting together, we just stared at the image in front of us. And what we saw was a lone camera looking over the city of Baghdad from across a river. We just sat there watching this image as CNN anchors prattled on about what we might witness at any moment. But we just sat there waiting, watching, waiting to see the beginning of a war unfold in front of us. You see, we had been promised, if you remember those days, the U.S. military had promised that the beginning, the initial phase of the Iraq invasion would begin with what they called shock and awe. A shock and awe campaign. And it was a remarkable, if not disturbing, thing to be alive in 2003. We would be able to watch the shock and awe of war unfold in front of us live from the comfort of our couches. You know, the authors of the Shock and Awe War Doctrine, Harlan Ullman and James Wade, they describe the theory behind shock and awe this way. Impose an overwhelming level of shock and awe against an adversary on an immediate or sufficiently timely basis to paralyze its will to carry on. Seize control of the environment and paralyze or so overload an adversary's perceptions and understanding of events that the enemy would be incapable of resistance at the tactical and strategic levels. Shock and awe war tactics, they're designed to bring an enemy to its knees quickly with a display, a raw display of power, you could say. And for 90 minutes, my friends and I sat after class watching that TV screen, watching. And then an explosion, a fireball, followed by the sound of matter breaking and being torn apart, and then another, and then another, and then another. We watched in real time as bombs exploded all across the city of Baghdad. Shock and awe. And we witnessed it live on TV. Because the reality is, shock and awe, it wins wars. Shock and awe makes an enemy submit. Shock and awe brings the enemy to its knees. And this idea of using shock and awe as a war tactic, it's not new. It wasn't invented for that war. It's been around for centuries, even millennia. In fact, think about World War II. It's early spring of 1945, and the U.S. is having great success in the Pacific theater of war, but they're desperate to avoid a land invasion of Japan. They know that's going to cost so many lives to invade by land. And so the cost seeming too far, too high, they need a different way to bring the Japanese to their knees in this war. But things aren't going according to plan for them. You see, instead of fighting man-to-man, the idea that they had is they should cripple the Japanese war machine. And specifically, they want to take out the Nakajika aircraft plant in Tokyo. And the thinking is simply this: if the US and its allies can take out Japan's wings, this factory was responsible for building and manufacturing Japan's Air Force. If they can take that out, they'll have dominance of the sky, and that means they can end the war via air dominance. They never would have to put a boot on the ground in Japan. And so the plan has been simple. For the past 6 months, they've been attempting these high-altitude precision bombings, and they want to avoid civilian casualties. They just want to take out the Japanese war machine, but for 6 months, they've been trying these precision bomb tactics, trying to bomb specifically this factory, and they keep missing, and missing big. Sometimes they miss by more than 12 miles, and they can't figure out why they keep overshooting their target. Of course, at the time, what they didn't know is there was this thing called the jet stream, and it's a powerful force. It's so powerful that it was increasing the speed of their high-altitude bombers. It was increasing their speed by more than 100 miles per hour. And so right when they thought they were over their target, right over this plant, they were well beyond it. By the time they released their bombs, they were well past this factory. Precision bombing wasn't working. And so by early 1945, it was time to change tactics, and General Curtis LeMay is brought in to solve the problem. And if you haven't listened to Malcolm Gladwell's series on General Curtis LeMay, I would advise doing so. But he's the one to come up with a new plan. And so the plan is essentially to do the exact opposite of what they were trying to do before. Instead of flying high altitude precision bombings during the day, they're going to fly low altitude night raid bombings. It's going to be a campaign of shock and awe, and they're going to use indiscriminate bombing with the new technology of the day, which is napalm. And so instead of precisely targeting one thing, they're not really going to target anything. They're just going to carpet bomb low altitude during the night. And so on March 9th, 1945, 334 B-29 aircraft, they take off into the night sky on a mission called Operation Meeting House. And these planes are loaded with as much napalm as they could carry. And the target is no longer Nakajika Aircraft Plant. It's simply Tokyo. Specifically, a highly densely populated area of Tokyo called Zone 1. In the first planes that arrive on the scene, they drop flares just to light up the night sky, give a target for those falling behind. And then the bombers behind them come in flying at just 5,000 feet. And they bomb in clusters with these little canisters. They only weigh 6 pounds, but each of them are loaded with TNT and napalm, and they drop thousands of them. And the idea is that on impact, these little bombs would send burning globs of napalm in every direction. The plan was to use shock and awe, just totally overwhelm the Japanese. And surely by doing that, it would make them submit, bring them to their knees. And so late on March 9th into March 10th, all told, 1,665 tons of napalm were dropped on Tokyo in just one night. And by 2:37 a.m. on March 10th, the shock and awe resembled a hellscape. It was one of the worst fires in the history of humanity. The largest of the fires in Tokyo was 40 blocks long and 15 blocks wide. By an hour later, 1,000 city blocks of Tokyo were on fire. It said that the glow from the fire was visible 150 miles away. It was a fire of such intensity that it had its own wind and weather system. In total, 41 square kilometers of Tokyo are completely leveled by fire. And after the war, the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey would conclude this: probably more persons lost their lives by fire at Tokyo in a 6-hour period than any time in the history of man. More than 100,000 people died that night. That's more than the lives that were taken by either of the atomic bombs at Hiroshima or Nagasaki. One pilot and witness would go on to say that when those cities were on fire, it was like looking into the mouth of hell. And the U.S. would go on to firebomb another 66 cities in Tokyo. Only two big cities were spared from this firebomb technique. Those were, of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And their fate would come with a different sort of shock and awe campaign, a different tactic. Instead of a ton of bombs, one bomb. But the devastation was the same, and I marvel even as I shudder thinking about this. In the history of humanity, it is thought that more people lost their lives on that night than any other in human history. Of course, months later, August 15th, 1945, the Emperor of Japan surrendered. The shock and awe campaign had worked. And why? Because shock and awe win wars. Shock and awe makes enemies submit. Shock and awe brings an enemy to its knees. And you might be thinking, well, what does this have to do with Christmas, Brad? I mean, this is a little depressing for the Christmas message? Well, to me, it has everything to do with it, because you see, the same tactic that was used in Iraq, the same tactic that was used in Japan was afoot 2,000 years ago in Jesus' day. And you know the story. Herod, the king at the time, right, upon hearing the news that a rival king has been born, he decides he's going to go with this precision bombing technique. If he can just get the magi to tell him where this child is, he can focus in on him and take him out. But of course, the magi won't tell him. And so he opts for a more indiscriminate tactic. He opts for a campaign of shock and awe. This is what it says in Matthew 2. When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. Shock and awe wins wars. Shock and awe makes an enemy submit. Shock and awe brings an enemy to its knees. And I'm reminded through all of these stories that when wars are fought with shock and awe, it's always the innocent who suffer. And whether it's more contemporary, like drones over Yemen, or planes over Baghdad, or firebombs over Tokyo, or Herod's decree, whatever it is, fight that way, and it's always the innocent that suffer. Fight that way, it leads to the slaughter, the destruction of innocents. Choose to fight in any capacity, and it's always the innocent who lose. And yet, as awful as these stories are, they're part of our makeup as humans. You see, shock and awe, power and violence, force of will, it's part of who we are as a species. It's part of the human condition, and it moves well beyond the theater of war. I mean, yes, that's the worst of it, but it sort of works down a ladder as well. The same motivation is what motivates us to bully or shame people on social media. It's our propensity to always want to fight with those who disagree with us. It's the temptation to shut down people's voices, to meet difference with power. It can even be something as simple as when your children are screaming or crying, how do we respond? So often the temptation is to do what? To yell and scream louder. This shock and awe tactic, it's part of who we are. The ones with the loudest voices, the biggest crowd, the harshest posts, the biggest bombs, they always win. And this is what makes the Christmas story so special to me, unique. It should be no surprise, knowing all of this, that when Jesus is born, he arrives with, you could say, his own campaign of shock and awe. And like the night sky over Baghdad on March 19th, 2003, or the night sky over Tokyo on March 9th, 1945, the night sky above a little town called Bethlehem is about to be lit up by an army, an invading army. It's an army performing a campaign of shock and awe. And like any shock and awe campaign, this one is also very much about regime change. Except this campaign, which is about regime change, well, it looks a little different than the shock and awe tactics that we know and are familiar with. And of course, what I'm talking about is the familiar story of Christmas. It's the reason we celebrate Christmas. Every Christmas Eve, right? People recite Luke chapter 2, and this is what we're told. But think about it through the eyes of shock and awe. Here's what happens in Luke 2. And there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord, and this shall be a sign unto you. You will find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly the angel was joined by a vast host of others, the armies of heaven, praising God and saying, glory to God in the highest and peace on earth, goodwill to men. You know, this story is so often made out to be cute, and you know, it is cute at Christmas time seeing kids perform the story, the angels, but what we are witnessing here in this story is actually a night sky invasion. The night sky of Bethlehem is being lit up by an army. This is the Christmas story of shock and awe. Like Baghdad or the Tokyo night sky, Bethlehem is lit up by the power and color and sound of an invading army. It's an army from another world, an army representing another government, an army from heaven. And this army has come to cause regime change. Make no mistake about that. The Caesars and Pharaohs and Herods and dictators and US presidents and prime ministers, they're being supplanted by a newborn ruler, what Isaiah calls the long-awaited Prince of Peace. And this is why the armies of heaven are invading the night skies over Bethlehem. Regime change is coming. You know, in the Old Testament, more than 250 times, God is described as the Lord of armies. And here, God's armies are revealed now at the birth of Jesus. And they appear in this campaign of shock and awe. And this, of course, is why the shepherds are so afraid. They're standing at the mercy of a vast army hovering above them in the night sky. They're terrified. An army has arrived, and that can only mean bad things. You know, there's a reason that once again, the very first words from the angels are what? Fear not. Do not be afraid. You see, this army, unlike other armies, it doesn't come to bring fear or violence or destruction. No, this isn't that kind of army. This is a totally different kind of army. I love how Brian Zahn sums this up. What does this army in the sky mean? Brian Zahn says this: this is not a killing army, but a singing army. This army comes not to kill, but to carol. The army of heaven is a choir, combat by chorus. The army of heaven doesn't launch missiles, it launches into song. The heavenly army sings of the glory of God and of peace on earth. Oh, that is so good. I love it. Instead of firebombs or drone strikes or death squad decrees, the armies of heaven, they come singing songs. Christmas story is one that pleads with us. Rethink everything from justice to relationships to politics. There's a new regime in place, and it's come to give us a new way to live and move in the world. It's not the way of the bomb. It's the way of the baby. It's not the way of power and force and manipulation and coercion and shock and awe. It's the way of peace and songs and goodwill. Vulnerability. And it asks us to use our imagination. Maybe, just maybe, the world doesn't change and revolve the way we think it does. And maybe it's time for us to trust that the world actually moves through peace, goodwill, following Jesus' way and path in life. And you might say, well, that's naive. Maybe. A utopian pipe dream? Possibly. But for the weary and worn like me, I would rather take my chances on Jesus and his path of peace than a lot of the other vying for power that I see around the world. It feels to me like the same old story playing out time and time again, recycled revenge. Jesus says, there's a new way, a better way. Follow me, not just my life and my teachings. Follow the way of my birth, which is what? Be people who sing songs of peace, who offer goodwill to others, and come to others in vulnerability.